Good morning, honorable members, and good morning, colleagues. Masi, can we start?
Yes, Chair.
Okay, thank you. The agenda.
Is it visible, Chair?
Yes, it is, Emas. Once more, good morning, honorable members and colleagues. I won't switch on my video because I'm using my gadget, which is my phone, for today. So this is the agenda that has been flighted by Emasi, and you are all welcome to this meeting. We are proceeding with the two bills, and of which, as per this agenda, there are two items: the briefing by the Parliamentary Legal Services on the constitutionality of these two bills, and of which it was the presentation that were part of our items last week, but it was removed for today, so that we give the team to further check all the issues that were raised in our public Lantika hearings. And then we'll get the submissions and all the proposed amendments as the next item by the NSG. And with those few words, you are all welcome to this meeting. And I will ask Masi to present the apologies that I know of one from the minister, Honorable Nokolo Kivit, and also Masi, the Honorable Ntuli will join late, flying from KZN. Honorable Maneli will also join late, attending to the second portfolio committee that she's part of. I'm not sure of other apologies, Masi.
Yes, thanks, Chair. Thanks a lot. It's just Honorable Komani. She's also delayed, Chair. Thank you so much.
No, thank you very much. Those are the few apologies, Honorable Members, as I have welcomed all of you to this meeting with only two items. And I also welcome the Deputy Minister. I think she's here, Honorable Kana Pilani Machake. Now that the minister is not here, DM is always part of our meetings. And just before the two presentation, I will hand over to yourself, Honorable Deputy Minister. Thank you. Honorable DM.
Good morning, Chair. Good morning to members of the committee, members of the public. Chair, I'm not really sure.
Just hold on, Honorable DM. I've seen there's a hand of Pindile Mkwanas from the NSG.
Thank you, Chair. I wanted to render the apology for our principal. He's out of the country, so I'm representing him. Thank you.
No, thank you very much, Ms. Mkwanazi. I have welcomed all of you, Honorable DM, and yes. I have said there are only two items for this meeting. One is the first item is the briefing by the Parliamentary Legal Services on the the two bills. The item that was removed from our agenda in the last week's meeting, portfolio committee meeting, the team is here. That will be the first presentation. And the second presentation will be the National School of Government, and of which the principal is not here, but Ms. Mkwanazi will then represent the NSG, which is on their proposed amendments. And I know that, honorable members, there was a letter that was sent to us, and also it was also signed off by the minister, honorable DM. And that gives the NSG to present their proposed amendments of the especially for the PAMA, not for both bills, only PAMA. Thank you very much. And then I was handing to you just to do your opening remarks just before the presentation. Thank you very much, Honorable Deputy Minister.
Thank you very much. Chairperson, and to acknowledge also the presence of senior management from the National School of Government here with us in this meeting, members of the public. Indeed, Chair, I've actually also just seen the agenda that's going to be looking at the constitutionality of the two bills, the Public Service Amendment Bill and the Public Service Management Bill. Chair, on the 16th of October, 2023, the Minister of Public Service and Administration sent a letter to the chairperson of the Portfolio Committee suggesting further amendments to the Public Administration Management Amendment Bill to be considered during public hearings. These amendments are mainly on the second sections of the bill that talks to the NSG as a government department responsible for provision of education, training, and development in the public sector. The presentation by the NSG will be on the proposed amendments, which are mainly on clause 11 of the bill. The provisions we are amending is on conducting of examinations or tests and issuing of certificates. Looking at the bill, Chair, I don't know whether I should now request Ms. Mkwanazi to do the presentation, or you'd first want to go into the section that's going to be looking at the constitutionality of the two bills. May I hand over back to you, Chair?
Thank you very much, Honorable DM. I'm handing over to the first presentation.
Good morning, Chairperson. My name is Talana Halley. I am from the Parliamentary Constitutional Legal Services Office. In this meeting with me is my colleague, Taloshni Gangan, and she will be speaking to the Public Service Amendment Bill. I'll be considering constitutional legal issues relating to the Public Administration Management Bill. I'm going to share my screen, if you allow me to just do so. Let me just start. And then just for bandwidth purposes, I think I'll switch off my my video. Chairperson and committee members, there were lengthy submissions made with regards to the Public Administration Management Amendment Bill. And the background to that, I'd just like to point out that the CLSO has considered the Public Administration Management Amendment Bill, B10 of 2022, the presentation from DPSA, and that was presented to this committee last week, correspondence from the Minister of the DPSA, Ms. Kiviat, the various written submissions delivered to the Portfolio Committee, and the oral submissions that took place on the 18th of October. At the outset, I'd like to point out as well that the CLSO considered the legal and constitutional issues raised in these submissions, but for the purposes of this presentation, we only address the legal and constitutional issues. Policy issues have been left to the executive to address, which they have done so last week. Chairperson, The presentation is quite lengthy, so I'll try to keep it as succinct as possible, as there were, as I explained earlier, a number of submissions. The presentation is divided into two aspects. First, the drafting and technical responses, and then responses relating to the constitutional content of the bill. The drafting issues raised in the submission were issues relating to definitions. Definitions of secondment, organ of state, operationally justified, and ex officio. The constitutional interpretation issues and questions raised in the bill relate to Clause 2, which is the amendment to the Section 5, Clause 5, which is the amendment to Section 8, Clause 6, which is the insertion of Section 8A, Clause 7, the amendment to Section 9, Clause 8, the amendment to Section 10, and Clause 12, the deletion of Section 16(2). Clause 14, which is the insertion of the new Section 17A and 17B. We encourage the committee members to follow the presentation along with a copy of the bill in order to grasp a better understanding of legal services responses. Issues relating to drafting. Submitters raised the following issues. Should the definition for secondment differentiate between transfer and secondment? Should the definition of organ state be aligned with the definition contained in 239 of the Constitution? And should operationally justified be defined? Is this insertion not constitutional? Should ex officio be defined? We respond as follows. There is no need to define secondment or transfer. The terms, in terms of drafting prescripts, the definition is to avoid ambiguity and has three broad classes. A definition needs to delimit, to extend, and to narrow. Considering the dictionary definition of the term in as used in the context of the PAMA, these terms are not used to delimit or extend or narrow, and therefore there's no need to define it further. In terms of organ of state, the definition is constitutionally compliant. The current definition is in line with the Constitution, but it goes further as it is a definite meaning which includes public schools. This is because the exercise of public power and the performing of public functions is a school public school function in terms of the School Act. The definition is therefore correct, as DPSA has confirmed that this is a policy decision to make it clear that the PAM is applicable to public school employees too. The amendment to insert operationally in Section 6(2) is not unconstitutional. And we say this because in terms of drafting prescripts, definitions are only included if operationally is an adverb that has a dictionary definition of with regard to routine functions, especially in terms of an organization. Therefore, considering the rules of interpretation, it is understood that where consent cannot be obtained after representation is made by an employee, secondment can take place if necessary for the routine functioning of the organization. It is therefore also not necessary to define ex officio. Once again, the definition of ex officio is resulting from one status of position or position. Clause 5 of the bill uses the term in the amendment to Section 8 to clarify that the term director does not only mean director appointed as a result of the position of director of the public entity, it means director in terms of a company's act. The amendment is to avoid an employee being a director of the company and doing business with the organ of state. The next few slides, I'll consider the constitutional and interpretation issues raised by submitters. The first issue relates to Clause 2 of the bill, which is the amendment to Section 5, which deals with individual transfers. Submitters questioned the following. Firstly, does the amendment to Section 5 mean that all requirements in Section 5(2)(a) to D would need to be present in order to transfer an employee? We respond as follows. Yes. As Section 5(2) contains a list of requirements followed by an and, all aspects of 5(2)(a) to D will need to be present in order to transfer. Will an employee only be transferred if he or she requests to be transferred? Section 5(2)(c) indicates that an employee must either request or consent, and this can be interpreted as a consent following an instruction. So therefore, not only a request for transfers result for transfers. An employee can also be requested to transfer. Who does the onus of the transfer rest on? The onus does not rest on the employer. the may in section 5.1 stipulates that there's no obligation or onus on the employee to transfer an employee. Further, section 5.2d stipulates that the consent must be obtained from the executive authorities to agree to transfer. Clause 3 of the bill deals with section 6, which is secondments. There was one submission and a question whether should we align section 5 to section 6. Our response is this is not necessary. The two processes are very different. Transfer is permanent, while secondment is temporary. Clause 5 of the bill, which is the amendment to section 8 and the conducting of business with the organs of state. The submission relates to section 8.1 of the amendment, which includes directors, meaning a director who is a director of a company as defined in section 1 of the Companies Act. This therefore means that it includes directors who are directors of MPOs. And clarity was sought with regard to this. Our response is as follows. A not-for-profit company is defined in the Companies Act as a company incorporated for public benefit as required in item 1 of schedule 1 of the Companies Act. Director is defined as a member of a board of a company. Company means a juristic person incorporated in terms of the Company Act. Therefore, a director of a not-for-profit company will fall under the definition of Companies Act. The department has indicated in their previous presentation that this was a policy decision to ensure the directors of MPOs be included in the prohibition, but has now proposed a further amendment to 8.4, which we have welcomed. The second submission relating to Section 8 was whether to extend Section 8 to scenarios where you are a beneficiary of a company but not a director. Once again, this is a policy decision, and the department must indicate if this was the intention. Clause 6 of the bill relates to the new insertion of Section 8A. The submission is as follows. Section A retains restricts trade of a former employee and infringes constitutional rights. Section 22 of the Constitution states that every citizen has the right to their trade and occupation or profession freely. The practice of trade, occupation or profession may be regulated by law. All rights in the Bill of Rights can be limited by Section 36. If you consider case law such as S versus Makwanyane, the weighing up of competing values is ultimately an assessment of proportionality. Therefore, in order to consider the limitation to the restraint of, the limitation of the right to trade in Section 22, we need to consider the nature of the right, the importance in an open and democratic society, the purpose for which the right is limited, the importance of that purpose to such a society, the extent of the limitations, its efficacy, and particularly whether the limitation has to be necessary and whether the desired end could reasonably be achieved through other means less damaging to the right in question. It is under our understanding that the purpose to limit trade is to protect the interests of the state and avoid corruption. The department will need to confirm whether this is the reasoning behind the section and what was its intention in order to proceed with a proper assessment of proportionality of the limitation to Section 22 of the Constitution. Clause 6 of the bill considers Section 8A, which is a new insertion. Submitters aver that Section 8A1 states that an employee who sets a criteria for award or evaluates or adjudicates may not within 12 months after conclusion of the contract accept employment from a service provider. Submitters state that the submission proposes a rework. The submitter states that a rewording be proposed as it is not an employee who sets the criteria, but rather the bid committee. Our legal response is as follows. Section 76.4c of the PFMA empowers National Treasury to make regulations or issue instructions applicable to all institutions to which the Act applies concerning the determination of a framework for an appropriate procurement and provisioning system, which is fair, equitable, transparent, competitive, and cost-effective. Usually, each department, trading entity, and constitutional institution will contain its own set of internal regulations. So, yes, essentially, an employee will not single-handedly set the criteria of a bid, but may form part of a team who does set a criteria or adjudicates or evaluates the bid. We therefore suggest a tighter drafting of this section may ease the submitter's concern. Clause 7 of the bill is the amendment to Section 9. The submission says that the insertion of the definition 9.3, which contains the word employee, should be extended to include a person contemplated in Section 12A of the PSA, which is a public entity, and someone performing a similar function in a municipality. Our response is as follows. Section 9 of the PAM governs the disclosure of financial interests by an employee. The bill proposes that subsection 3 state that an employee should disclose financial interest. Employees is defined by the PAM as a person appointed to the public administration, but it specifically excludes those in terms of 12A of the PSA. Public administration is defined as public service, municipalities, and the employees, whereas public service includes national departments, all of Part A of Schedule 3 of the PSA, which includes the government printing works, national intelligence, amongst others, and the provincial departments, including the Office of the Premier, and the provincial government's components in Part B of Schedule 3. It does not include public entities. And the reasoning behind this is that public entities are not included in the PSA, as that these are often statutory organizations established under the legislation that governs the organization and its employees. Usually, this is a policy decision whether to include public entities, but this would take a greater legislative overhaul, as each entity would need to be considered on its own, and their legislation would need to be considered and need to be aligned to the PSA. Clause 8 of the bill considers Section 10. Submitters have stated that the amendment prescribes that the head of the institution must make budget for compulsory education and training. This is must direct the submitters aver that this infringes on the employee's rights by requesting compulsory training. Our response is as follows. Compulsory training may not always be applicable. This can be seen from the word may. If you look at Section 195 of the Constitution, it prescribes the basic values of and the principles of governing public administration. And Section 195(1)(i) provides that the public administration must be broadly representative of the South African people with employment and personnel management practices based on ability, objectivity, fairness, and the need to redress the imbalances of the part to achieve broad representation. Section 195(3) provides that national legislation must ensure the promotion of values and the principles listed in subsection 1. Therefore, there is no basis of this submission. The section ensures that preference is given to transfers and promotions from a pool of candidates that have undergone a prescribed training program and are certified to be able to perform the predetermined scope of work. The purpose of the section is to professionalize the public service, which is in line with the Constitution. Clause 12 of the bill considers Section 16(2), which is deleted. The submission states that the minister must prescribe minimum norms and standards in terms of subsection 1A in consultation with the relevant executive authority. By deleting 16(2), the consultation with the relevant executive authority provides the minister with an absolute authority to determine norms and standards. The question was, is this legally permitted? Our legal response is as follows. It is not clear the intention of the deletion, but the Act empowers the minister to set norms and standards. The norms and standards can be done via regulations in terms of Section 18 and will be subject to public comment in terms of Section 18(4) of the PAM. There is no obligation for the minister to consult the executive when they make norms and standards. The section in the Constitution simply states that the national legislation must ensure the values and principles in subsection 1. Clause 14 of the bill, which is the new 17A and 17B, 17A is the removal of disparities in the public administration. There were 2 points raised by submitters. The first point was, what are unjustifiable disparities? Should there not be a definition for this? Disparities are defined as the difference in level of treatment. Disparities can occur in relation to remuneration and conditions of service. These can be justified in terms of the level of employment, amongst other things. It is understood that 17A is there to ensure that these disparities are not unjustifiable by drafting norms and standards to ensure that. These disparities will be unpacked in the norms and standards, and hence, it is our opinion that there's no need for a definition here. The second question relates to 17A, which applies that the minister determines norms and standards that will affect the remuneration and conditions of service of municipalities, and this undermines the structure of the municipalities and the constitutional right of local government to structure and govern their own employees, and which infringes on the autonomy of municipalities. We've heard extensive legal representations from Professor Chiel, who represented the department. However, we'd like to also add that public administration is defined as public service employees, municipalities, and their employees. Therefore, 17A proposes that the minister will, subject to legislation governing the employment of employees in public administration, establish norms and standards. If you consider Section 66 of the Local Government Municipal Systems Act, which governs staff establishment and specifically provides that the municipal manager within a policy framework determined by the council must approve staff establishment, provide job descriptions attached to these posts, remuneration. Also, if you consider Section 71 of the Systems Act, it provides that the municipalities must comply with any collective agreements concluded by organized local government within the mandate on behalf of local government. Section 151(3) of the Constitution also provides that a municipality has the right to govern on its own initiative, that the local government affairs of its community subject to the national and provincial legislation as provided by the Constitution. However, a municipality's right to govern is not boundless, and Section 153 of the Constitution provides that a municipality's right to govern on its own initiatives, the local government affairs of its community, is subject to national and provincial legislation as provided by the Constitution. Furthermore, if you consider Section 154 of the Constitution, it states that national and provincial governments, by legislative and other means, must support and strengthen the capacity of municipalities to manage their own affairs, to exercise their own power, and to perform their own functions. Case law, such as the Constitutional Court's judgments of Marafong, Habitat Council, and Independent Outdoor Media, provide precedent that national or provincial government cannot intervene in the functions, an emphasis on functions, that the Constitution reserves for municipality. National government may not legislate on any functions or competencies which a municipality has sole mandate of. However, national government may provide a minimum standard and framework to enable municipal functioning. 17A does not usurp the power of a municipality to exercise its original legislative powers by requiring that prior ministerial approval must be obtained when governing discussions around salaries or curbing remuneration disparities. The section provides for norms and standards and further does not determine that the minister must prescribe norms and standards, but provides that the minister may prescribe norms and standards. However, we welcome the proposal by DPSA to tighten the drafting in order to convey this intention of the provision. Section 14 of the bill is the new Section 17B. There were a number of questions raised regarding the new 17B, one being that the 17B limits the bargaining power of a municipal employee and an employer and undermines the autonomy of municipalities, therefore conflicting with the existing legislative measures and creating tension between these matters. Another question was, does 17B infringe on the mandate of the Minister of COCTA? Another question was that 17B contradicts the constitutional right to collective bargaining, and particularly if you consider 71 of the Municipal Systems Act. Finally, another question was regarding 17B contradicting Section 66 and 67 of the Systems Act, as the Committee of Ministers can now reject bargaining council propositions and the power to negotiate, which is the mandate of SOLGA. The CLSO welcomes the redraft as proposed in Section 17B, as proposed by the DPSA, which now distinguishes between public service, local government, and public entities, and provides a clearer understanding of the intention of the section, which is to ensure that an employer in public service obtains a mandate from the Committee of Ministers before a collective agreement with financial implications is entered into. CLSO further expresses that the section should properly reflect that in respect of local government and public entities, it is required that the Minister of Finance and the MPSA only be consulted before collective agreements with the financial implications are entered into. Thank you for your time, members.
Thank you very much, Ms. Hali. The next presentation is NSG, and I will hand over to yourself, Ms. Mkwanazi.
Thank you, Chair. Good morning, everyone. I'm going to hand over to my colleague, Given, who's going to do the presentation for us.
Thank you, Chairperson, and good morning, DM, Chairperson, members of the committee, colleagues, members of the public, all protocol observed. Thank you. The purpose of our presentation is to respond to the submissions from the public hearings on the clauses dealing with the National School of Government, insofar as they are in the PAMA bill. We are also seeking the portfolio committee's favorable consideration of the minister's proposed changes. At the onset, we wish to advise that the minister welcomes and accepts the proposed changes to sections 11.2c and 11.2f of the PAMA bill, wherein it is proposed that the discretionary word may be replaced with a peremptory word must in order to entrench the legislative mandate of the NSG. In terms of section 11.2c, we are proposing that as per the public submissions, we replace the word may with must, insofar as we will be providing education and training programs to public entities. Our view is that the NSG is partly funded by government and it relies heavily on revenue that it generates. So if we make use of the word must, we don't anticipate that given that opportunity, the NSG would otherwise not seize the opportunity to generate revenue so that it can pay its employees and make sure that it is able to operate accordingly. When it comes to section 11.2e, we are proposing that we insert the word examinations just before the word test. This is necessary to ensure that for the qualifications that we will offer, we are in a position then to grant, I mean, to conduct examinations. Our view is that there is a difference between what a test is and what an examination is in the South African context. And as an example, a test may or may not contribute towards a final mark, but an examination is that assessment which ultimately determines whether a person progresses to the next level or not. We are therefore proposing, members, that we include the word examinations. There has been an idea, though, that says that perhaps we might want to remove both examinations or tests and just replace that with the word assessment, because that is a broader word which encompasses both examinations and tests. We are amenable to that. When it comes to section 11, or just before there, we are also proposing that because we have added a new section, we must therefore delete the word end at the end of section 11.2e. We have also proposed that we have a new subsection, 11.2f, where we specifically recognize attendance, proficiency, and non-formal education through skills development program. The recognition under this particular section is that the NSG would like to award certificates of attendance or certificates of participation, certificates of proficiency, or certificates of competency. This is outside of your formal education. Hence, then we thought that it would be an important section to add. We are, however, not married to this particular section being F. We may even put it at the end. It doesn't change the meaning, members. We went further then and indicated that, in our view, rather than complying only with the National Qualifications Framework, we would like to comply with all applicable education laws. The key word here, members, is that it is applicable education laws and not all laws. As an example, if one looks at Section 51 of the Higher Education Act, that is a piece of legislation that empowers the National School of Government as an organ of state to be able to provide higher education. The second piece of legislation in the education space is the National Qualifications Framework. So we are proposing that instead of just mentioning the National Qualifications Framework Act, we must also just say all applicable education laws. I've spoken to this particular slide when I was dealing with the proposed amendments. The other proposal is that we add definitions to the bill. This is primarily to limit cross-referencing, which would be found in the education laws. We are, however, not opposed to the idea of not having these definitions in the bill, but rather leaving them in the relevant acts where they are. The NSG would kindly request that the committee considers the proposed amendments favorable. Thank you, members.
No, thank you very much, Kevin. Honorable members, those are the two presentations from the legal team and also from the proposed amendments to PAMA by the NSG. Now I will take hands for clarities or questions. Honorable members, for both presentation. I can see the hand of Honorable Schreiber. That's the only hand I see for now.
Good morning, Chair, and good morning, colleagues. And thank you very much for the presentation. I do just want to flag that I think the input we've heard from Ms. Halley regarding the constitutionality of this act, the Public Administration Management Act, impacting on the local government sphere is a far more contested proposition than what we've heard. In fact, I have seen legal advice that has made it clear that it would be unconstitutional for this act to extend the influence of the Minister of Public Service and Administration into the local government sphere. So I do want to caution at this stage, Chair, that we are very likely going to trigger a conflict on the one hand involving the Minister of Public Service and Administration, on the other hand involving a range of local municipalities, and potentially also involving the Minister of Cooperative Governance and Traditional Affairs over the extent of these particular powers affecting certain aspects of human resource practice. So I would urge from my side that we reconsider this particular approach. It is related to Clause 17, but there are other parts of this bill that similarly try to signal that it applies to local government level as well, when the Constitution is very clear about the autonomy of local governments. So at this stage, I just want to put on the table and on the record here that I foresee legal challenges and legal problems if we proceed with the bill as is, and that it would be advisable for us to actually avoid such a situation by making it clear that the bill does not extend the powers of yet another national government minister into the local sphere. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Honorable Striper. I've seen the hand of Honorable Kibi, and then followed by Honorable Notnakhan. And I've been told by Masi that the legal services, they want to say something on the PSA, but I will give them after Honorable Members because they have not indicated.
Yeah, thank you, Honorable Chair. Good morning to you, and good morning to the people that are also on the virtual platform. Honorable Chair, mine is to NSG. On the proposals, E of may conduct examinations or tests or course examinations or tests to be conducted in respect of education and training programs or courses, which is the preferable description between examinations, tests, and assessment, which is an all-encompassing word. That is what I want to get. And on parliamentary legal advice questions, Honorable Chair. Clause 7 of the bill, amendment to Section 9, to what extent would consequential amendments be required, and did the Parliamentary Legal Service assess which acts or entities would be impacted? And also on Clause 6, Section 8A, restrains trade of a former employee and infringes constitutional rights and reference to Section 8A, Clause 1. An employee who sets a criteria for the award, what proposals does Parliamentary Legal Service think are the parameters of former employees to be restrained? Those are my questions, Honorable Chair. And I thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Kibi, Honorable Notnakhan.
Thank you, Chair, and good morning to everybody on the platform. And I would also like to say thank you for the presentation. I've got only one question, and it would be the following. It's on Clause 5 of the bill. Amendment to Section 8, conducting business with organs of state. And I want to know, does the Parliamentary Legal Service identify a risk of NPO directors conducting business with organs of state? That will be my question, Chair. Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Notnakhal. I just saw a hand of Honorable Komane.
Thank you very much, Chair, and good morning, colleagues and members who made the presentation, and let us welcome both the presentations. Chair, I am partly covered by the latter speaker in terms of the question posed. And further, Chair, I would also ask what the legal services has provided us with. Does it not imply that the minister will then be imposed to the local government, which I also feel that it would also cause conflict within the local government's autonomy. So, and further to say, Chair, where does this also leave the Department of COGTA in this? Are we not foreseeing a conflict between both departments, the COGTA department and the Public Service and Administration Department? And further, Chair, maybe if it can be at lengthly explained, Uti, where will then the autonomy of the local government go? And then what would then happen? Because as Honorable Schreiber has said, I for one also see the conflict which might also be opened to litigation or something. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Honorable Komane. I will then first, before you respond to these questions, give the legal services just to say something on the PSA, because they've just indicated that they've two or three things on the PSA. Thank you, Ms. Delan.
Good morning, Chairperson, and good morning to all on the platform this morning. My name is Filoshni Gangan. I will be talking to the committee about the Public Service Amendment Bill. Chairperson, with your permission, may I turn off my video as I start speaking to the committee?
No, that's fine.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, in an attempt to assist the committee, the Constitutional and Legal Services Office has considered the Public Service Amendment Bill. We've considered the presentation from the DPSA last week. We've looked at oral and written submissions delivered to the Portfolio Committee. We've looked at relevant case law. We've considered all the legal and constitutional issues raised in the submissions. And the purpose of this advice is to address only the legal and the constitutional issues. The policy issues have been left for the executive to address. We are in agreement with the submissions of the department as presented last week, save for two clauses which we wish to expand on. I will turn to address the concerns relating to the constitutional content of the bill. Clause 16 is the insertion of a new clause 36A, which deals with the limitation of political rights. Clause 16 seeks to insert 36A to the Principal Act to prohibit heads of department and employees reporting directly to a head of department from holding an office of authority in a political party. The purpose of this prohibition is to ensure that there is a clear demarcation of politics from the administrative roles and responsibilities. This seeks to eliminate any potential conflict of interest that may arise insofar as it relates to heads of departments and employees reporting directly to that head of department. There was a concern that this provision may not withstand scrutiny. Our response to that is Section 36 of the Constitution deals with the limitation of rights. Section 36 states that the rights in the Bill of Rights may be limited only in terms of a law of general application to the extent that limitation is reasonable and justifiable in an open and democratic society based on human dignity, equality, and freedom, taking into account all relevant factors, including the nature of the right, the importance and the purpose of the limitation, the relation between the limitation and its purpose, and less restrictive means to achieve that purpose. when we looked at case law, violation of constitutional rights, my colleague mentioned S versus Makuniani. I'm going to deal with a case called Durek versus the Director of Public Prosecutions. It's a 2002 Constitutional Court case. And in this, the court reiterated that rights contained in the Bill of Rights are not absolute. Rights have to be exercised with due regard and respect for the rights of others. It said organized society cannot operate on the basis of rights being exercised harmoniously, can only be operate on the basis of rights being exercised harmoniously with the rights of others. Of course, the rights by an individual may come into conflict with the rights exercised, having regard to Boxler. State law advisors are tasked with the solemn responsibility of ensuring that the state is able to deliver on its obligations, promote the rule of law, and give effect to the values enshrined in the Constitution. State law advisors scrutinize, develop, draft, and certify all primary legislation before it is introduced in Parliament. It is the responsibility of state law advisors to ensure that it's compatible with the Constitution and other legal instruments and that it will withstand constitutional muster. Chairperson, the reason I clarify the role of Oxler is because there was a difficulty with regards to what had transpired regarding the amendments and during the NEDLAC process. I'm going to at the end just say what Oxler and I have managed to do. But before that, let me deal with the beginning and Clause 18. So Clause 18 deals with the amendment to Section 38 of the Principal Act. Clause 18 seeks to amend Section 38(2)(b) Roman numeral 1, which was declared unconstitutional by the Constitutional Court in the matter of Public Servants Association on behalf of Obogo. The bill makes provision for overpaid salaries to be recovered with the written consent of the employee, and where no consent is provided, overpayment may be recovered by way of legal proceedings. That goes on to say, in the event that the employee is employed in another department, provision is made for the debt to be recovered by the head of the department of the new department. The recovery of overpayments from persons no longer in the employ of the state require legal proceedings or by way of deduction against any monies owed by the state. Clause 18 proposes to amend Section 38(1)(a) of the Public Service Act in order to provide that a head of department, as opposed to the relevant executive authority, shall correct an incorrect salary, salary level, salary scale, or reward that was rewarded to an employee. Clause 18 also proposes the amendment of Section 38(2)(b) Roman numeral 1, which was required in light of the unconstitutionality of that section. The court also said in this section that the employer no longer being able to use Section 38 to unilaterally recover monies that were wrongly paid to employees in the absence of due process or agreement by the parties. In order to ensure that the bill will pass constitutional muster, the Office of the Chief of the State Law Advisor considered whether the proposed new amendments to Section 38(2)(b) Roman numeral 1, as opposed to Clause 18 of the bill, will address the concerns of the Constitutional Court as set out in the Obogo matter. In the PSA Obogo matter, the court found, in relation to the current Section 38, that although it's a statutory mechanism to ensure the recoveries of money wrongly paid to an employee out of the state coffers, The provision gives the state free rein to deduct whatever amounts of money allegedly wrongly paid to an employee without recourse to a court of law. It went on further to say that the provision imposes strict liability on employee. Deductions may be made without the employee concerned making representations about her or his liability, and even the liability about, or even the ability to pay the installments. In addition to this, the court had an issue with recovering wrongfully granted remuneration. And it said, wrongly granted remuneration involves two parties. And in the case of a dispute, a third independent and impartial party should arbitrate if one of the parties, in this case, the employer, is the one that arbitrates, then this party becomes the player and the referee in its own case. So it's evident from the court's finding that the court has a huge issue with the unilateral determination by a department as to whether there was an overpayment, how the amount would be paid, and how it should be recovered, even when the employee disputes the indebtedness. The difficulty that we are faced with the proposed amendment of the section as contained is that failing consent, the accounting officer is still the judge in its own cause, which is in violation of Section 1C of the Constitution. There also seems to be an unjustified differentiation between employees who are still employed by the state and those who are no longer employed by the state. In light of the above, and in an attempt to assist the department, Oxler, together with myself, have redrafted a proposal for the committee to consider. I would like to just share my screen, Chairperson, with your permission.
Yes.
Thank you. So the new proposed clause that we have drafted reads as follows. By this substitution in subsection 2 for paragraph B of the following paragraph, and this is not the important part, B. Being overpaid or received any such benefit not due to him or her, an accounting officer may recover such overpayment by way of deduction from the employee's salary if the accounting officer and the employee agree in writing on the amount of the overpayment, on a reasonable period for the repayment of the amount of the overpayment, and on the amount to be deducted from the employee's salary, either in full or in monthly installments, taking into consideration the employee's income and current financial obligations, provided that the total deduction is not more than one quarter of the employee's monthly salary, or an accounting officer may, in the absence of agreement as contemplated in sub I, recover such amount of overpayment by way of legal proceedings. An accounting officer shall, in the event that the person is no longer in the employ of the department, recover such amount by way of deduction from any monies owing to such person or by way of legal proceedings. Further, it goes on to say an accounting officer shall, in the event that the employee is in the employ of another department, request the accounting officer of that department to recover in the manner contemplated in subparagraph Roman numeral 1 or 2, the overpayment or that other benefit shall be discontinued or withdrawn as from current date, but the employee concerned shall have the right to be compensated by the state for any patrimonial loss which he or she has suffered as a result of that discontinuation or withdrawal. Chairperson, that is what Oxler and I have come up with in an attempt to remedy any shortcomings of the current clause in the amendment bill. That is the end of my advice, Chairperson. Thank you very much.
No, thank you very much, Ms. Tiloshini. And now that we have not received this presentation, can you then send it to Masi so that he sent it to honorable members? It was, we can't comment or ask questions because this presentation have not been sent to us, but I have allowed you to present initially. I should have requested that you don't present in this meeting. So please share this presentation with ourselves as Portfolio.com so that we just we peruse it. Thank you very much. And I will then hand over, because there were questions that were asked by honorable members, and I will start with the presentation of the legal services, the first presentation, to respond to some questions that were asked by honorable members. And they will then follow by the NSG. Thank you very much. And thank you to you, Ms. Tiloshini.
Thank you, Chair. I think I'll first address Honourable Schreiber and Honourable Kumani's question, because I think that they were related. Honourable Schreiber, although we do agree that the municipalities are autonomous, I think I'd like to emphasise that we believe that 17A does not usurp municipal power to exercise original legislation. Our advice is that we are mindful of a municipality's right to govern, but this is not boundless, as pointed out in our presentation. And 17A must properly reflect that it is a section which is there for the sole purpose of supporting and strengthening capacity of a municipality to manage its own affairs. And that leads me to Honourable Kumani's question, which was, you know, if this is the feeling by legal services, then what do we propose a redraft should look like? In order to ensure that we are not imposing on the autonomy of a municipality. And we'd like to point out that at this juncture, we can't propose as legal services what a redraft should look at, because at this point, the committee hasn't deliberated on 17A. The committee hasn't agreed to a redraft. There hasn't been a resolution to redraft that section. But if there is a resolution to redraft that section, we, alongside Oxley, will then consider various proposals made in this committee and present something to the committee. And then, leading to Honourable Kibi's question, the question whether an impact assessment was done with regard to public entities. No, we did not do an impact assessment. The decision to include public entities will lie with the DPSA. But our response was simply that should public entities be included, this will take a very lengthy and tremendous amount of legislative overhaul and possibly consideration of many various consequential amendments. But we believe that it's up to the DPSA to decide whether or not they would like to include public entities. And then the last question was Honourable Nothnachel's question, which was regarding Clause 5, the risk relating to doing business with MPOs. Once again, this we believe is a content and policy question. We do not consider the risks involved in doing businesses with MPOs. The inclusion, we believe, in including MPOs was a decision taken by DPSA that to avoid employees receiving remuneration, even from companies that are not for profit. And that is all in terms of questions. I think I responded to everyone. Thank you, honourable members.
Thank you, Ms. Delana. NSG.
Evan, will you please respond?
Thank you. Faith, where are you?
Thank you, Mr. Mdijwa, and good morning to committee members and all protocol observed. I will respond to the question with regard to which word will be suitable between assessment, test, and examination. So the suitable word, which is encompassing, is assessment, because assessment includes your formal assessment, which includes your test, and also your practice. It includes your projects and other stuff, and also it's inclusive of your practical assessment and summative, which is examinations. The current model that we use for assessment at the NSG is also inclusive. Some of the assessment, we use portfolios of evidence. They also do practical work and support. So the way that will be suitable to include is assessment, because it's inclusive of both test and examination. And which test and exams are excluding practical components, and also your projects, and also the portfolios that the learners are currently submitting to the NSG. Thank you.
Are you done, NSG?
Yes, ma'am. I think that was the question that was asked. It's okay. Only about the date of assessment.
Okay. If there are no further questions or clarities from honorable members, because I don't see their hands, I will also again give the DM if she wants to say something. DM after these two presentations. In fact, there are three.
Chair.
Hi, Honorable Dr. Kondwe.
Good morning, Chair. My apologies for interjecting, but it's just a plea for Parliamentary Legal Services to ensure that we at least receive the presentation on the Public Service Amendment Bill by close of business today, because we will be considering it clause by clause as a committee tomorrow.
No, thank you. I think Ms. Diloshin will send that presentation to Mercy and for members.
Thank you, if Chair.
That's good. If there's no further clarities or questions or follow-ups from honorable members, I will hand over to my Honourable DM, Honourable Shana.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. Let me welcome the presentations that have been made and the comments that followed, and to say yes, we are on the right path towards professionalizing public service, really building capacity for the state in order for the state to deliver in a much better way. We've noted the concerns that have been raised in terms of areas that might actually have some kind of conflict. And I think as the committee deliberates, the committee will actually also give this direction, because the bill is now before Parliament. We are going to continue to be available for technical advice. And I wish to actually also reiterate that we should carefully look at the interface of administration and state so that we shouldn't actually come up with something that might along the way maybe pose some kind of challenges. Concerns, Chair, have been raised about the role of COCTA, which I think as the committee deliberates, the committee will actually continue as we refine this bill to look at what implications are there. And I think what would be important along the way is just to ensure that even COCTA is on board. And maybe even with the National School of Government, we need to be sure that the Higher Education Department is actually on board, because whatever is actually being mentioned about tests and examinations bothers on the mandate and policies of the Department of Higher Education and Learning. Thank you, Chair, for the opportunity.
No, thank you very much, Honorable TM. And now Ms. Dikoloshin is saying the presentation has been sent to Mercy. And honorable members will get that presentation. We are then moving to the next item, Mercy.
Yes, Chair, it's closer, Chair.
Okay. No, thank you very much to all of you. Once more, thanks to yourself, DM, and the team and your team, and also the legal team led by Ms. Mkhwanazi, and also the NSG, and honorable members, colleagues, our support staff. Thank you very much. And now we are at the end of this meeting. Now the time is 10:42. And thank you very much. And the meeting is adjourned until we meet next week. Tomorrow, I mean, on Wednesday, when we're going to deal with clause by clause and then conclude the following week. Thank you very much, honorable members and colleagues. Goodbye.
Thank you, Chair. Goodbye.
Thank you. Goodbye.